Hashtag you don't have to be Jewish.
Dr. Carl, we've missed you. Where have you been, you science communicator, you?
Flying all over the countryside, going to Adelaide, talking about waste, recycling, better life, being able to fix global warming and actually bring down carbon dioxide levels. Messages of good hope and being positive, Dr. Howard.
Absolutely awesome. Well, listen, I mean, talking about hope, the Darien Gap really is about hope, isn't it?
It's a strange thing. I've heard about the Darien Gap on and off over the years and never really understood what it was, so I decided I would fix up this gap in my education. There's North America, which is big and clunky, and there's South America, which is also very big, and then there's a skinny bit of land joining them. And by the way, a bit of South America is in the Northern Hemisphere. Okay, that's not my fault. I don't accept any responsibility for that. And then when you go to the big clunky bit, the South America, there's a state there called Colombia. And then next to it is, in the skinny bit, is a state called Panama. Mm-hmm. And there's a 200 or so kilometer break where there ain't no road. And when I say road, I'm referring to the Pan American Highway, 30,000 miles, 48,000 kilometers. And it runs all the way from Alaska down through Canada, continental, contiguous USA, Mexico, and through a whole bunch of states until you get to Panama, and then it just stops, 200 kilometer gap, and then picks up again and goes all the way to the tip of South America, Ushuaia. And it's full of untouched, densely packed old growth forest and raging rivers and vast cloud forests and mangrove swamps. And if you try to go through by foot, you run the risk of being robbed by bandits or kidnapped by gorillas or suffering a slow, painful death by snake bite. Mm. But nevertheless, some 90,000 people try to go through by land and many of them die and they're just trying to find a better life. And I've got to point out this is a little bit of a, what I'd call a conflict of interest, because I myself spent the first few years of my life growing up in a refugee camp. So I've got sympathy for people who want to go somewhere to have a better life. So, but anyway, that's the Darien Gap. And because it's so untouched, it's got massive biodiversity. It's dangerous, one of the wettest places on earth, but also when it rains, a calm river can turn almost immediately into a raging river. And if you're walking, you might have to cross 15 rivers a day. And if you camp by a riverbank, you could be get washed away during the night. But people will do it. And scientists go in there looking for stuff that we don't know about. And every now and then they get kidnapped until they can convince the gorillas that, hey, I'm just a scientist. I don't have any money. Nobody's going to pay for me. Let me go. It's costing you money. And eventually they do. And there was one expedition where they managed to get some vehicles through in the 70s, and it was called the British Trans-Americas Expedition. They had a whole bunch of Range Rovers, which kept on blowing diffs all the time, their differentials. So they finally went back to regular countryside to the north, got themselves an old, old, old rugged agricultural Land Rover, and only had to rebuild it a couple of times to get all the way through.
It really is just so tragic on so many levels, because it really does talk to that level of desperation. Are you comfortable just to share a bit of your history? Because I think the value in that is that it actually shows it makes it real and personal for our listeners. You know, I think we tend to see the refugees. Carry on.
Yeah, so both my mother and father had been in German concentration camps, and my father had been in a Russian camp, and he'd managed to escape on two occasions, and the third time he got liberated by the Allies coming through, as did my mother. They moved to Sweden, and in around 1950 or so, Sweden felt threatened from Russia doing aggressive things to Finland. Right. And it's just a hop, skip and jump. So they decided to get the heck out and go to somewhere further away from Russia. So there we were on the dock waiting for the ship to come in, and the ship came in to take us all to the United States. And then I threw a spanner in the works, me, a little 2-year-old kid. And what I did was I had a fever in response to my recent smallpox vaccination. The ship went away without us. The fever went away, and we're still sitting on the dock with our cardboard suitcases, and the next ship coming up is, say, hey, you want to go to Australia? Sure, anyway, just get us out of here. And that's how I end up in Australia instead of the United States.
Incredible. So, and it is interesting because you do then develop a sensitivity to it. And when you know, I think so many of us see refugees, we see this whole migrant situation as just masses of people. We don't see the 2-year-old you sitting on the dock almost looking towards a new life and your parents trying to find that new life for you after their lives were destroyed.
Yeah. And it was very interesting with Ukraine being invaded by Russia, and a whole lot of news reporters were looking at Ukrainians coming to other parts of Europe, and they said, oh my God, these people look like me. They're white and they're Christian. How can they possibly be refugees? Doesn't that happen to people with a different skin color and a different religion? And suddenly it began to hit home that any of us, if things go badly, can become a refugee.
Absolutely. I think that's such an important perspective. Thank you for sharing that with us. Let's talk about N95 masks.
Yeah, for a long time, I had it totally wrong. I thought that N95 masks worked simply because they had lots of layers. But instead, they've got very clever technology inside. So if you think about standing in a forest clearing and you look out to the outside world, what do you see but no horizon? There's just trees everywhere you look. And I kind of thought that that would be the case in an N95 mask, that while a virus particle was very small and the holes were big, you had so many layers, you know, 10, 100 or whatever overlaid, that eventually a virus particle would run into a fiber. But no, they've got a very clever trick. On the outside, facing the world, they've got a water resistant layer. On the inside, facing your skin, they've got something that likes your skin. It doesn't irritate it. And in between, they've got only two layers of a mesh that has been blown from plastic under high speed with wind, and it forms automatically a fibrous mesh. And then they give it an electrostatic charge, so it actually sucks the particles onto itself. If it did not have that permanent electric charge, in the same way that a magnet is always north and south, if it didn't have that permanent electric charge, then the efficiency would be 10 times lower. Now, they call it an N95 because it catches 95% of the particles.
Right.
But if they didn't have that clever trick, so it's got a permanent electric charge to suck the virus and the water droplets onto itself, it'd be 10 times less efficient, and we call it an N9.5 instead of an N95. So that's the kind of the highest level you can have for personal domestic wearing on the street, as it were.
Absolutely fascinating. Before I let you go, I want to know this. How did Saturn get its rings and when?
Well, we think it happened about 100 million years ago because we looked at the resonance. There is a resonance, apparently, between the orbit of Saturn and the orbit not of Uranus, the next planet out, but Neptune. Oh, my God, there's some sort of resonance between them. And this got broken 100 million years ago. And we think that 100 million years ago, a moon, maybe 300 kilometers in diameter, got torn apart when it got too close to Saturn. I'll give you an example of how something gets torn apart. Imagine that you've got something 400 kilometers above the ground, like the International Space Station. That takes an hour and a half to go around the Earth.
Right.
1,000 times further, 400,000 kilometers away, and that takes a month or a moon to go around. Now, imagine that that's a single body.
Right.
The closest part is 400 kilometers away from the Earth, and it wants to go around in an hour and a half. And the furthest part wants to go around in a month or a month, and so it tears itself into pieces. It's called the Roche limit, R-O-C-H-E limit. I've given you an extreme example, but that's how the gravitational field of a planet can tear apart a moon when it gets too close. And that moon was made almost all of ice with hardly any rock in it, which is why the particles are all icy rather than rocky.
Very, very interesting indeed. That's where we unfortunately do have to leave it. Dr. Carl, thank you as always for a fascinating discussion.